I don't know how many trials you've had before the high days, but we sure had a bunch. All kinds of things happening. Not the least of which is what happened Saturday. I was supposed to be speaking the last day, and turns out it's today. So my message today is going to be entirely impromptu. I've never done that before. So that may explain the bomb. I don't know. We'll see. But let me start out with a little lighter matter, and it's something we've discussed at previous nights to be much observed. But can you cite the four important things that happened on the night to be much observed? I'm not going to give you the answer right now. If my memory serves me correctly, I will try and do that before we finish. But I just want to plant that thought. There were four important things that happened on that night, not just one thing. So while I'm speaking, maybe the thought will come to mind and you can recall some of those things. But my subject today, and I think Coy's message was a good foundation for it, is what I'm going to call the Naaman effect. You might remember Naaman. You can find him mentioned in 2 Kings chapter 5. Basically fills that chapter. But it's an interesting story, and it has a lot to do with us, and that's probably why the story is in there. It tells us a lot about ourselves, even though this is someone else. His experience is very similar to some of the things that we encounter while we are performing the various unique activities that relate to this season of the year. We do some pretty weird things, don't we? We wash one another's feet. Who does that? And we do it regularly. And then we get all the leaven out of our houses. I mean, we've heard of that before. The Jews do it too. But most people, most, let's say, naturally minded people, would look at that stuff and say, that's rather strange. You don't need to do that. Well, let's consider something. Let's go to 2 Kings chapter 5 and look at the story about this man, a very prominent man in his particular nation, in high favor with his king, an accomplished military leader. Starting in verse 1, now Naaman, captain of the host of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master, and honorable, because by him the Lord had given deliverance unto Syria. He was also a mighty man in valor, but he was a leper. And the Syrians had gone out by companies and had brought away captives out of the land of Israel, and among them a little maid, just a little girl. And she happened to be a handmaid to Naaman's wife. And this little girl made an innocent little comment that almost inflamed the Middle East. Read the rest of this. And she said unto her mistress, would God, my Lord, were with the prophet that is in Samaria, for he will recover him of his leprosy. And the word got out. It got amplified in the courts of the kingdom. And it got all the way up to the king. And one went in and told his Lord, saying, thus and thus saith the maid that is of the land of Israel. And the king of Syria said, go, and I will send a letter unto the king of Israel. And he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver and 6,000 pieces of gold and 10 changes of raiment. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, who was completely blindsided by this, didn't know what to make of it, and perceived that it might even be a threat to the peace in his kingdom. He brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, now when this letter is come unto you, behold, I have therewith sent Naaman my servant. This is from one king to another. I have therewith sent Naaman my servant to you, that you may recover him of his leprosy. And it came to pass, when the king of Israel had read the letter, that he rent his clothes and said, Am I God to kill and to make alive? That this man sends unto me to recover a man of his leprosy? What's he doing that for? Wherefore, consider, I pray you, and see how he seeks a quarrel against me. I guess the king of Israel figured that if he didn't do it, like it was told that he could, then it would be an insult against the kingdom of Syria, would it not? Verse 7, and it came to pass when the king of Israel had read that. Verse 8, and it was so when Elisha the man of God had heard that the king of Israel had rent his clothes, that he sent to the king, saying, Wherefore hast thou rent thy clothes? Let him come now to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel. This thing blew up so big that the word got around the whole city, that the word even got over to Elisha. This was no small matter. A little girl's comment, and before you know it, two kings are posturing against one, or at least they perceived, the king of Israel perceived that they were posturing against one another with the intent of having it out. Verse 9, so Naaman came with his horses and with his chariot and no doubt with his entourage and stood at the door of the house of Elisha. Here is this important man standing at the door, no doubt of a humble abode of a simple man of God. And Elisha didn't even bother to come to the door. Verse 10, Elisha sent a messenger saying, you know, go dunk yourself in the Jordan River 7 times. How would you react to that? I mean, the Jordan River was not known for its purity. And the guy doesn't even come to the door to greet you. You're important. You're one of the greatest men in the kingdom of Syria. I'm sure Naaman was thinking, doesn't he know who I am? The king sent me to your king, and you don't even come to the door. You send a servant out and tell me to go jump in a river. No doubt Naaman was not happy with what took place. Verse 11, but Naaman was wroth, understandably so, considering his self-perceived importance. And he went away and said, Behold, I thought he will surely come out to me and stand before me and call on the name of the Lord and do whatever he does and strike his hand over the place and I'll be recovered. See, Naaman thought it was going to all be done for him because he was so important. Certainly. He didn't have to do anything. Just stand there and Elisha would do it all and he'd be healed. Didn't involve him doing anything himself. He didn't have to do anything to demonstrate his faith, which he probably didn't have up to that point in time. You know, Naaman's protest was, verse 12, are not Abana and Pharpar, rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? May I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in a rage. You see, he still was on a mindset where he regarded his own superiority. Do we see a lesson in that? But his servants approached him and spoke unto him and said, My father, if the prophet had bid you to do some great thing, wouldn't you have done it? You know, if the prophet had bid him some great thing, well, that would reflect on his stature as a person. You know, go and do some great deed, because then you can demonstrate your greatness even more. and then you'll be healed for that. No, no, it wasn't any works that Naaman was asked to do. He was, in effect, asked to humiliate himself. Verse 13 again, and his servants came near and spoke to him and said, my father, if the prophet had bid you to do some great thing, wouldn't you have done it? How much rather then when he says to you, wash and be clean, why not do it? What's so hard about it? The only thing that was hard about it was accepting the humiliation. Elisha, in effect, insulted the man. He asked him to do a humbling thing. When's the last time you washed yourself in the Colorado River? I mean, that one's probably better than the Jordan, but it stinks like fish and mud and I don't want to say what else, but it stinks. What would you think about that? As a prerequisite to observing these days or something. Would you do it? Verse 14, then went he down and dipped himself seven times in the Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God. And his flesh came again, like unto the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. How do you suppose that affected his attitude? Contrast the before and the after. And he returned to the man of God, and all his company came and stood before him, and he said, behold, now I know that there is no God in all earth but in Israel. Now therefore I pray, take a blessing of thy servant. Elisha came out to meet him at this point. He was ready for Elisha to meet with him face to face. Verse 16, but Elisha said, and as the Lord liveth before whom I stand, I will receive none. And he urged him to take it, but he refused. Elisha wouldn't take payment or any credit for what God had done. Now, how does that compare to our circumstance? When we observe these days, we do some things that most of the world would regard as strange. Even the religious world was strange, unnecessary, in a way humiliating. But what's it all about? What's it for? What lessons do we learn in this season of the year? When we wash one another's feet, we demonstrate a willingness to be a servant. Not just a servant, but the lowest level servant. There may be only one other job I can think of that we would do for one another that might be below this one, but let's just stick with this one, washing one another's feet. When we do that, is there any element of protest in our minds about that? You see, that's where the key comes in. We put 11 out of our houses. And there's several approaches. You can roar through your cabinet, grab all the stuff that's obviously 11, throw it out, you're fine. But we know there's more than that because the stuff is everywhere. It's everywhere. When you've been eating in your house for a whole year, there's crumbs, there's bits of food, there's stuff under the fridge, there's stuff in the fridge, there's stuff in the freezer, it's in the carpet. One of the lessons we learn about unleavened bread is that we can't do it. We just can't do it. There is no way we could ever get all the leaven out. It's impossible. Because it's also microscopic. What's our attitude about that? Do we ever, to any degree, say, this is necessary or this is not necessary? Is there any, what I'm looking for is any kind of subliminal mental objection or subliminal mental protest, no matter how mild, to what we're doing. Because that's what this gives us a chance to see. Putting leaven out doesn't do one thing for us spiritually as far as our earning anything. We earn nothing except we learn a lesson. That's the difference. But it allows us to see something that Coy alluded to. Because we do need to be somewhat rebellious. And we think of rebellious as against other people. I'm saying we need to be rebellious against our own natural minds. We have two minds. Anyone who has God's Spirit is operating on the basis of two minds. We have our natural mind, and we have the mind of Christ, which comes to us through His Spirit. And those two mentalities war against one another. And it's the exercise of washing feet, and it's the exercise of putting leaven out that exposes the battle between those two minds. And when we mentally protest, we are exposing that battle that might be otherwise unseen. Do you follow my point? How spiritually minded are we? The physical things are immaterial. Absolutely immaterial. Spiritually. Yet, they're essential to bring out something that we could never otherwise understand about ourselves. In Luke 12:29, and for speed, let me just read these to you. They're not complicated verses, but there's a number of things here that I think we need to understand. Luke 12:29, "And seek not ye what you shall eat or what you shall drink, neither be you of doubtful mind." And it's that doubtful mindedness that maybe we need to think about, because it can happen. Paul recognized the battle between the two kinds of mentalities, our natural mind and that which we received from God's Spirit, in Romans 7:23. "But I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin which is in my members." In verse 25, he says, "I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then, with the mind I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh the law of sin." He calls out this contrast in Romans 8:5, continuing the thought. "For they that are of the flesh do mind the things of the flesh, but they that are after the Spirit, the things of the Spirit." We have two different mentalities that we can work with. And we're always going to have that natural mind. The question is, how much of it can we push into the background? Romans 8:6, "For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace." Our own natural intellect is not going to ever count for anything towards salvation. "Because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be." Not only the law of God, but the things of God. "And he that searches the hearts," in verse 27, Romans 8:27, "he that searches the hearts knows what is the mind of the Spirit, because he makes intercession for the saints according to the will of God." He knows we need constant intercession because we are what we are. Not only do we sin, but we are sinners. Though we may conquer the urge at times, it doesn't change what we are. It only changes what we do. We need constant intercession. In James 1:8 it says, "A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways." And that's what this is. We are all double-minded if we have God's Spirit. There's going to be that competition of thought between the flesh and the Spirit. Paul battled with it as his status in conversion. He battled it right up to the last. 1 Corinthians 2:16, "For who has known the mind of the Lord that he may instruct him? But we have the mind of Christ." Ephesians 4:23 tells us, "Be renewed in the spirit of your mind." There's a second component. Philippians 2:5, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. An issue came up, even at Passover, between and among the disciples. It was the issue of who was to be the greatest. John 13:5-14 talks about that. Christ corrected them on that more than once. They argued among themselves on the road from Damascus. On the road up from Jericho. They argued among themselves about this even at the Passover itself. Who was going to be the greatest? Christ told them the one who's going to be the greatest is the one that serves the most. And the one who serves the most effectively is the one who serves the most willingly. As to the greatest, Christ said, don't even think like that. You shall not be so, Luke 22:26. But he that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he that is chief, as he that does serve. Matthew 23:11. But he that is greatest among you shall be your servant. But we can use these days as a barometer. We look at clocks, we look at thermometers, we look at barometers. They each tell us something. Tell us something we couldn't necessarily perceive of our own senses. That's also true of these matters of foot washing and unleavened bread. They give us a barometer to sense our attitude. And I don't think there is a person alive who has been through this, who has done this, who hasn't at some point in time entertained a slight inkling of, this is silly. Do we really need to do this? Does God really want us to do? You know, there is, to some varying degree, I'm sure, in each one of us, at times, in the back of our minds, the old natural way of looking at things. It's how we are. It's how we think. But these days, give us the chance not just to do things that don't really make all that much difference, but what they give us is the essential means of testing our dedication, our faith, our willingness to be obedient, our willingness to serve, and our willingness to do whatever God says. Not because we earn anything by it, but because we learn a great deal by it. So that's the message that I see buried in the what I call the Naaman effect. It's a barometer on our attitudes. This man illustrated some of the very characteristics that we exhibit at times. Our self-importance. We're so important. I mean, people should recognize how important I am, defer to me in anything. You know, if I ask them to do it, no. We should be serving them first. Not because we're so important, but because it's important that we serve, that we exhibit the Christ-like character to do that. So that, I would say, is the subliminal message of these days. And I hope it helps that we understand some of the dynamics of what we're doing. Now, back to my original question, I asked about the four things that occurred on what we call the night to be much observed. I see it as perhaps the most ancient, ongoing observance in all of history. The four things, I'm not going to tell you what they are. I'll let you do it on your own Bible study if you ever run out of things to study. The four things are found in Genesis 15, Exodus 12, Joshua 5, and the four Gospels. And the thing in the four Gospels involved a rolling a stone. So I think from that you can get number four at least. But think about it. These are important days, and they're more important perhaps than we might originally have thought.